Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. Our guest this hour is the author of Only a Theory, Evolution and the Battle for America's Soul. Kenneth Miller is a professor of biology at Brown University, co-author of four high school and college biology textbooks that are used by millions of students in this country. In 2007, he was named a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and received the Exploratorium's Outstanding Educator Award. He lectures widely and has been in court on this subject several times. We'll talk about that, certainly. He's appeared on NPR's Science Friday and also on the Colbert Report. Hey, how's that for something to put on your resume? The intelligent design movement, he talks about being inaccurate and also dangerous to the American soul, to the practice of science and all learning in America. He's been in several different lawsuits, but you'll recall this because it received a great deal of national attention. He was the lead expert witness for the successful lawsuit that forced the school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, to abandon efforts to replace evolution with intelligent design. Our number, we're going to get calls on this, I'm sure, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to join us by email, that's okay, and you can do that by going to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Kenneth Miller, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
How many lawsuits have you been involved in?
just two.
Was it just two?
Your introduction almost made it sound like I was a half-microscope, will-travel kind of guy. I've been involved as an expert witness only in one, and that was the Kitzmiller versus Dover, the lawsuit in Dover, Pennsylvania that you described. And about a year earlier, I testified as a fact witness. The distinction is actually important to lawyers. In a case called Selman versus Cobb County. And Cobb County, Georgia, is one of the larger school districts in the state of Georgia, had purchased, this is back, I think, in 2002, they purchased new high school biology textbooks for all of the high schools in Cobb County. And that's a large number. It's like 13 or 14 schools. The textbooks, which I co-authored with my friend Joseph Levine, have a very good treatment of evolution, as any biology book should. An awful lot of people in the community, including several pastors and quite a few community leaders, were upset at the fact that these books didn't include creationism, that's how they put it, and they circulated a petition to the school board to say, hey, we want a book that teaches creationism. Well, the school board realized very well you couldn't do that because there's a Supreme Court precedent against it. So instead what they did is they put a warning sticker inside the books to say evolution is just a theory, not a fact, about the origin of living things. Well, a group of parents thought that this was an attempt to promote a particular religious point of view to the exclusion of other religious points of view. So they filed a lawsuit. And because I had written the book, Jeff Selman, the lead plaintiff, asked me if this went to trial, would I be willing to come down to Atlanta and testify? And I told him yes, and it did go to trial, and I did. So I testified in that case as well, and ultimately the federal courts in Atlanta ruled that Selman was right, that these stickers really were an attempt to promote a particular religious point of view, and they ordered them removed, and that's what's happened.
Yeah. You spend time in the book talking about why this kind of battle goes on in America and has for years and years. The thought must have crossed your mind at that trial and also in Dover that we were doing the Scopes trial again so many years ago, that we've been debating this forever in America, whereas when you have phone conversations with your buddies in England, they say, how can you be so stupid in America? What's going on there?
Well, that is an anecdote that I described. I'm a cell biologist, and I have friends in the field, in the discipline, all over the world. Most scientists do, because science is an international discipline. And quite a few of them said, you know, what's going on over there in the States? I thought you guys were a scientifically advanced country, and not just a scientifically advanced country, but the most scientifically advanced country in the world. And what I tried to explain to them was also something I explained in the book, is that if there's one thing that's part of the American character, it's a character of disrespect for authority. I remember reminding my Canadian friends of the essential difference between Americans and Canadians, which is that we were both colonies of Great Britain. The Canadians politely kept asking for their independence, and after 150 years, they finally got it. Americans picked up guns and shot at the king's soldiers, and that's how we got it somewhat more quickly. And this disrespect for authority is really part of the American character, and it's one of the reasons, I think, why people everywhere in this country feel as though they don't have to listen to what the smart guys at Harvard or Stanford or maybe the at Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, say. They can do whatever they want because this is a democracy, and they control their local schools, and they control their local school boards. Well, that culture of disrespect is one of the things that has emboldened state and local school boards to say, you know, we don't want to teach the theory of evolution, or we want to teach something else in addition to it. And you don't have that culture in Europe. Now, the paradox is that that culture of disrespect, I think, is also what has helped to make America such a great scientific nation. Because to do cutting-edge scientific research, you have to be willing to say, you know, I don't care what the authorities say. I'm going to try something different. I'm going to strike out on my own. And that culture of disrespect for authority, paradoxically, leads to a lot of disrespect for science, but it also leads to an invigorating climate in which we do a lot of great scientific research. We continue to dominate, and by we I mean the United States, we continue to dominate the Nobel Prizes on an international scale, and that's something worth valuing and something worth treasuring.
Yeah. We were talking at the ball game last night about your book because I, to tell you the truth, was reading it while I was at the ball game.
Oh, my goodness. I can give myself another commercial. Does this mean you were at Miller Park?
No, I wasn't actually. It was my son's high school game.
Oh, the high school game.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Go
right.
ahead. I hope he
which
did
is
well.
Even better. Which is even better. You know, I mean, tonight will be a big night at Miller Park, but it always is. But the high school games are better. But at any rate, somebody asked the question. I thought, well, this is a good question. Why do they call this a theory? Would the debate be just over a long time ago if it had never been called a theory?
Well, a lot of scientists have suggested, you know, maybe we ought to stop calling
right.
this the theory of evolution, or call it something like the law of evolution.
Right, right.
But in reality, I'm perfectly happy with calling evolution a theory, and I think most scientists are too. And here's the reason. To most people, the word theory means kind of like an educated guess, a hunch, something you're not sure about. So, for example, you know, in Milwaukee, you might have a theory as to why the Brewers are not going to make it to the World Series this year. I used to have a theory as to why the Red Sox would never win the World Series, but of course that was proven wrong. But that's not what we mean by a theory in science. A theory in science is a system of explanations. And we use theories in science to explain facts. And let me give an example of what I mean by that. When somebody studies physics, for example, one of the topics that they have to take quite a few courses in is called, and we still call this, atomic theory. Now, why do we call this body of understanding atomic theory? Do we call it that because, you know, we're not really sure if atoms exist? And maybe someday if we get better evidence for atoms, we'll call these courses atomic fact? Well, the answer is of course not. What a theory does is to unite, to explain, hundreds of thousands of experimental and observational facts. And that's what atomic theory does. It explains facts about the nature of matter. Well, what evolutionary theory does is it explains hundreds of thousands of observational and experimental facts about the nature of life. So in a way, theory is a much higher level of understanding than facts because theories explain facts. Theories never become facts, rather they explain them. And I'm very happy when someone says, well, evolution is a theory, I say, absolutely. Just like the germ theory of disease, the Copernican theory of the solar system, and the atomic theory of matter.
You write early in the book, let me go to this part, that that there's a soul at risk, that's the title here of
right.
your book, in America's Evolution Wars. It is our scientific soul that's at risk here. Tell me more about that. What does that mean?
Well, I love this country, and I think there's a reason why America, beginning in the first half of the 20th century and continuing to the present day, has led the world in science. And part of that is something I mentioned a few minutes ago, that culture of disrespect. Another part of that is that Americans are an enormously pragmatic people. What matters over here isn't, you know, who your parents or grandparents were. What matters over here is what you can do. And science is the ultimate what can you do profession. And what I mean by that is, of course, science as an enterprise is afflicted with all the problems. There's racism, there's sexism, there's political infighting and all this other sort of stuff. But ultimately, science depends upon getting the facts out of the natural world. So what it amounts to is that science is an area in which someone can make it and can make it big. And Americans recognize that. And one of the reasons why scientists come to our country from all over the world, and, you know, if anyone doubts that, have to take a look at the University of Wisconsin and look down the names of the science faculty, and you'll see how many of these people, clearly just by their surnames, have come from other countries to the United States. Well, it's not just because this is a great and prosperous country, which it is, but it's more so because the climate of scientific freedom here is so overwhelming that it just promotes free inquiry. What I worry about, and this is what I call our scientific soul, what I worry about is that the battle over evolution is really a battle over something much bigger. And that something much bigger is how are we going to regard science as a whole, and how are we going to pursue the acquisition of knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people who are deeply and strongly and fervently opposed to evolution will say, and they have said this in their own writing, that science is not the sort of unhindered search for the truth. Rather, science is kind of a way in which the dominant group, the dominant hierarchy, constructs stories about nature to reinforce its own views of society. And what they say is the dominant culture in America today is this atheistic materialist culture, and they construct this story called evolution. Well, they'd like to see what they call, and they call this, frankly, a theistic science, a science in which God is used as a causal explanation. And they say when we replace that materialist hierarchy with a theistic hierarchy, we will construct our own stories. These will be intelligent design and a kind of scientific creationism, and that'll be just as good as theirs. Now, what I worry about is not that the wrong hierarchy is going to win, but rather what I worry about is their very view of science is to make science a kind of subjective, relativistic discipline in which you're not looking for the truth. You're just trying to support a particular idea of what society should be like. And if that happens, science is not going to hold the kind of raw attraction for Americans that it holds today. And what I really worry about is if we come to view science as something that's unreliable, science as something that goes against traditional American values, and more of our young people come to that point of view, we're going to surrender world leadership in science, and the world is filled with a dozen countries who would be absolutely delighted to pick up that leadership from us. And I don't think that'd be good for us, and I don't think it'd be good for science in the world either.
We're going to welcome phone calls. There are a full bank of phones going for our guest, Professor Kenneth Miller. Only a Theory is his book, Evolution and the Battle for America's Soul. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, that is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now at 800-486-8655, starting today with Ken from Milwaukee. Hello, Ken. Ken, are you there?
Well, one Ken is here, but I'm the book's author. I'm not the caller.
Yeah, I know you are. Ken from Milwaukee, are you there? All right, let's go to Sarah from Baronet. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to. He kind of stole my thunder about the definition of a theory, but part of it, I was driving around the other day and I saw a car with all the sort of creationist bumper stickers. But the one that struck me was it was a picture of a car, and behind it said, "I will evolve." And I think that just speaks to the general misunderstanding. There's a fundamental lack of understanding of how evolution works and how the scientific method works. And the whole thing, and I think that's kind of the rub. I mean, you can't even have a discussion about it with creationists because they're not even playing with the same set of rules. I mean, if you try to talk about scientific method, it doesn't, I mean, you can't have provable results or falsifiable results if there's no way to falsify the idea. My favorite bumper sticker, though, is it says evolution is a theory, kind of like gravity. But it just shows a fundamental lack of understanding of how science works, and I think that's part of the problem.
Well, Sarah, and needless to say, I agree with you about that. And thinking about the bumper sticker you mentioned about gravity, that gravity is just a theory, I'm often confronted by people. You know, I might say the same thing, and then they might say, "But wait a minute, watch this. It's going to fall down, and therefore gravity is proven." Well, one of the really interesting things, and you can talk to any physicist about this, is it is a fact that objects fall towards the center of the Earth. That's the phenomenon. The theory of gravity is how you explain that. And as it turns out, explaining why gravity exists, why it's a force that can act at a distance, and why it's so weak compared to the other fundamental forces in nature, like the strong and weak atomic force, like the electromagnetic force, that's really tough. And in fact, physicists argue all the time about the satisfactory explanation for gravity. 2 years ago, there was a popular article in Scientific American suggesting one school of thought among physicists, which is that gravity is not a force at all. That gravity is an illusion that we have because we can't perceive all the dimensions of nature. So anyone who says, well, evolution isn't proven like gravity, just as Sarah said, has a mistaken understanding of the scientific method and certainly understands misunderstands the distinctions between theory and fact.
Thank you, Sarah, very much for the call. Thank you. Do you make a distinction? You talk about the creationists who lead trips down the Colorado River and, you know, explain here was the Earth designed, you know, in a very short period of time. Is intelligent design looking at the world was created just in a matter of days rather than created over millions and millions of years, all of our various species, et cetera? Or is it, has it evolved from that in some way?
Well, the interesting thing about the so-called intelligent design movement is that it was, from its inception, and its inception is about 12 or 13 years ago, a movement that was designed, pardon the pun, to sort of bring together everyone who objects to evolution under what has been called by the movement itself a big tent. And the idea of the big tent is that people who are opposed to evolution, many of them, just like you said, think that the Earth was formed about 6,000 years ago, that the entire geologic record was formed in a single worldwide flood, and that not just biologists, but geologists are wrong about the geology of the Earth because of this instantaneous formation, and astronomers are wrong about the age of the universe. So they think everybody in science is wrong. Now, there are an awful lot of people who still think evolution is wrong who don't want to go to war with everybody in science. These people might call themselves old Earth creationists or something along those lines. And they used to fight among themselves. The intelligent design movement came along and said, wait a minute, let's forget these differences. And let's put everybody under a big tent. And that big tent is objection to what they call Darwinism. And after we get the Darwinists, as they call us, out of the way, then we can worry about these other things. So within the intelligent design movement, you will find people who say, no. We don't believe anything about the age of the Earth because intelligent design could accommodate a 6,000-year-old Earth or a 4.5-billion-year-old Earth. So don't put that brush on us. But it turns out that the majority of people who support the intelligent design movement will agree with the assertion that human beings appeared in pretty much their present form 6 to 10,000 years ago without any other animal ancestors. And that basically is where that sits. So the official, and there is an official group, there's an outfit called the Discovery Institute based in Seattle, Washington.
Right.
They have a committee for science and culture, and they have done their best to promote intelligent design. And if you ask them how old is the Earth, they'll say, first of all, they're willing to accept what science tells us, and they have no position on the age of the Earth. But that really papers over a lot of differences in the intelligent design movement.
And we go back to phone calls. Next caller is Steele from Nina. Hi, Steele.
Yeah, good morning. I was wondering, I'm sure the guests had heard about the group called Science Debate 2008.
Absolutely, I am in fact a member of it.
The same problem, and not one candidate, Democrat or Republican, wanted to talk about those issues, and maybe they're afraid of offending certain people that still don't think carbon 14 has anything to say about anything.
Well, I completely agree with you, and I'm actually a member and a supporter of Science Debate 2008, and what this group has tried to do And we were trying to do this in the primaries as well, is simply to get the presidential candidates, now that we have two in the major parties, to say that one of their debates this year will be on issues of science. And the interesting thing is that you think about the crises that we confront as a nation, the global warming, the crisis with respect to alternative energy, and then important policy decisions in terms of conservation, land use, biofuels, the kinds of medical research that we'd like to do, healthcare policy, embryonic stem cell research, and so forth. It's astonishing how many of these important issues, and they're important to everybody, have a scientific component. Well, we think it'd be a great idea to just tell the candidates, for once, let's sit down and let's talk about these scientific issues. And unfortunately, we didn't get any takers during the primaries, and I am not optimistic. We're going to get a taker during the main debates, and I think that's a darn shame. And I think also that Steele is absolutely right that politicians on both sides, on the left and the right, both major parties, see this as a no-win proposition. I mean, it's not like scientists are an important voting constituency.
You know? Right.
Nobody tries to go out and get the scientific vote any more than they try to go out and get the votes of painters or writers, or for that matter, plumbers specifically, because these are all small constituencies. But what I would very much like to see is I would like to see both of the major candidates, and heck, I'd like to see the minor candidates too, address scientific issues. And it is unfortunate that at a time when science is so important to our nation's immediate future, that they're just sort of sidestepping the issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the percentage of American public now who questions evolution, Professor Miller?
Oh, well, let me take the word that you said. If you asked what's the percentage of the public that questions evolution, I would include myself among that, because I think everything in science has to be subject to question. The notion of I tell my students when I train my graduate or undergraduate students that there's only one dogma in science, and that is that science has no dogma. Now, that doesn't mean that all ideas are created equal. What science is very good at is discarding ideas, throwing ideas out that don't work. We do that all the time. But we don't have a dogma in the sense of having certain unquestioned beliefs. But if you phrase the question another way, what's the percentage of the American people who don't think that evolution is a correct explanation for the facts of natural history? It depends on how you pose the question, but anywhere from 40% to 60%.
That's remarkable.
Of the American people will reject evolution. That's the highest percentage of any industrialized country in the world, except for Turkey. Only Turkey among European nations has a higher percentage of evolution rejectors than we do in the United States. And the reason for that, and this will be interesting, the reason for that is because among Islamic fundamentalists, there's a growing movement to see evolution, and you'll love this, as a Christian plot to subvert the morals of Islamic youth. There's a very popular writer in Turkey named Harun Yaha, it's actually a pen name, who's written a whole series of anti-evolution books arguing that evolution is anti-Islam. And because of the high degree of Islamic belief in Turkey, these beliefs have really taken hold. But the United States stands behind every other one of our economic and scientific competitors in terms of acceptance of evolution. And I find that worrisome, if only because it can easily slip over to a rejection of science and the scientific method itself.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Steele, so much for your call. We go to Jim from Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Professor Miller. How are you?
Good morning, Jim. I'm doing great.
Excellent, excellent. Professor Miller, I kind of have from my view, as I was an evolutionist guy from up until about the age of 28, and I've kind of switched over to the creation side. And one of the biggest reasons I've kind of jumped over there is, for example, I have a hard time with evolution explaining how I got children. For example,
I was going to say, well, I write high school textbooks, and I can refer you to the chapter on reproduction to explain how you got children. But I think you mean a little more than that, Jim. So go ahead.
Yeah, what I mean is, I love science. I think science is great. I think our minds, just our ability to use our minds and look at things and do research for medical stuff, I think it's great. Science is really great. But I'm looking from the definition kind of from a theory to a fact. For example, it took me and my wife to come together to make a child.
Of course.
And that child was determined at whatever stage it was going to be a boy or a girl. Mm-hmm. And later on through life, unless the human race is able to come together again, two human beings join together again, through just what I observed in my short 40-some years here on this earth, we wouldn't, if unless people come together, unless somewhere in a lab that people, you know, that they come together and they make some sort of interaction for those that cell, there's no way that human life is going to continue. So that's my biggest stumbling block with, you know, Darwin. I think we've gone leaps and bounds above on our ability to research the cell and to look into things and to see the DNA. And I just wonder, why are we always jumping back to Darwin? Why don't we take that scientific facts, that research that we can observe, and excel onto that?
Well, first of all, I will agree completely with the first points you made, which is that procreation is necessary to the human race, and the good Lord has blessed me and my wife with two wonderful children, one of whom, in fact, is going to get married this weekend. I'm going to be the father of the bride in a couple of days.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks very much. Want to help me paying the wedding bill? Probably not. But So I agree completely with that. The people coming together and producing families is the basis of the continuation of the human species and our culture and our society. That's important. But when you say, why do we always go back to Darwin? Well, that's a good question to put to any scientist. And the quick answer you get from anybody is, we don't. We don't go back to Darwin. Darwin had no understanding of modern genetics. He didn't know about DNA because it hadn't been discovered yet. He simply looked at the facts out there in nature and said, I think that we can see processes operating in the world around us today that can give rise to new species, and this suggests that this is where existing species came from. Now, in the years since Darwin, we've had so many opportunities to test that sort of vague idea that he gave us. The science of genetics enables us to do that. The science of developmental biology, and above all, as you pointed out, the fact that we can look directly at DNA and we can see this. Now, you have, in Wisconsin, one of the leading scientists in the entire world doing this kind of research, and this is Sean Carroll at the University of Wisconsin. Sean is a world-famous molecular developmental biologist, and one of the great discoveries out of Sean Carroll's lab is that what he calls the toolkit, the set of genes that builds the animal body, is essentially the same in all animals. And by all animals, I mean not just human beings, not just other mammals, but even in insects. And this common body plan is exactly what you would expect if all organisms were related by evolutionary descent. And basically, we're not looking back at Darwin for answers. We're looking into DNA. And when you look at human DNA, and I can give you one more example if you want, it's profound confirmation of the fact that we got here the same way every other species did, which is to say we evolved. Now, Jim, if you're still on the line?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm still on the line. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
I just still have a hard time thinking, if we were table, if we all have that same molecule in us, then
yeah,
why couldn't we just sit and say, hey, I want to make a baby, and all of a sudden internally within us, a woman's body makes her own baby, and boom, there you are.
That would make life perhaps a little bit easier, but certainly a lot less interesting. And it would do away with an awful lot of Shakespeare's best writing and some of the most beautiful songs that we have. I'm kind of happy as a sort of a goofy romantic guy that love and sex are necessary for procreation, but I don't see anything. Not only do I not see anything that contradicts evolution, I see an awful lot that supports it. Let me give you an example of what I mean. As you know, ever since Darwin made a suggestion, biologists have assembled more and more evidence, a lot of it is fossil evidence, a lot of it is genetic evidence, that we share common ancestors with the other primates, with the other great apes in particular. Now, that's a testable hypothesis. You can check that out. And here's one of the interesting things. If you look at the other great apes, you know, gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans, you discover that they have 24 pairs of chromosomes. We human beings have 23 pairs. When you and your wife produced your children, those kids got 23 chromosomes from your sperm and 23 chromosomes from your wife's eggs. That's how they got 23 pairs. Now, you might say, wait a minute. If we human beings share a common ancestry with these great apes, there's a problem. And that is, they got 24 pairs, we have 23. Why are we missing a pair of chromosomes? And that's a very good question. Now, if the evolutionists are right, that chromosome has to be somewhere. It couldn't have just been lost. So the only possibility, and this is what I mean by being testable, the only possibility that would account for the fact that we just have 23 pairs is that in the line that led to us, a pair of chromosomes, which are still separate in the other great apes, must have gotten fused. They must have gotten accidentally stuck together to form a single chromosome. That's the only explanation that's consistent with evolutionary common ancestry. But here's the cool part. It's a testable explanation. It means that you should be able to look at our genome, and somewhere in the DNA, stuff that Darwin didn't know anything about, you ought to be able to find a human chromosome that is literally formed by the pasting together of two primate chromosomes, and it should have two copies of, it should have two centromeres, which each chromosome has. It should have telomeres, these very special DNA sequences at the tip. These should be right at the sort of the scotch tape holding these two chromosomes together. Well, guess what? When you look at the human genome, lo and behold, we have such a chromosome. And it has everything you would expect for a fused chromosome. It's human chromosome number 2. So even when you look deep into our own DNA, you see confirmation of our common ancestry with other organisms.
And thank you very much for the call.
Yes, thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, let's go to Dan next from La Crosse. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I just have an amateur interest in science, but strong interest in science of origins. Two questions and a comment, if I could, real quick. Could you distinguish between theistic science and theistic evolution? And could you distinguish between science and the philosophy of science? And could I share one verse of a poem I wrote?
Okay, science and I just want to make sure I got both these down before I go back to it. Okay, very good. I'll be thinking about that, and I'm looking forward to hearing your poem.
Okay, we've got the nucleotides, C, G, T, and A. If they could get together, we could have DNA. Evolve me, Jesus, let the pieces fit. Teach me to pray, not stray or quit. Evolve me, Jesus.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that. Let me take the first thing you said, and again, I'm just trying to get this from memory and scribbling down a few notes. So, Dan, if I get this wrong, correct me. You asked me if I could distinguish between theistic science and theistic evolution. Because I'm a Roman Catholic, and therefore a person of faith, people often characterize me as a theistic evolutionist. And I always say that I'm not. I'm a theist, as anyone who believes in God is, and I'm also an evolutionist. But to me, the term theistic evolution implies something that I don't want to imply. It implies that somehow there's this process that God is guiding, that it doesn't really happen, that God is behind the scenes pulling the strings. Well, I don't think that at all. I think evolution operates in the same way as any other scientist would say that it operates. If you believe in God, then you believe that natural processes are also the Lord's work, which is indeed what I think. Theistic science, as it's advocated, for example, by Philip Johnson, one of the leaders of the intelligent design movement, is a kind of science in which you use God as a causal explanation. And here's what I mean by that. Let's take the Christmas tsunami that devastated and killed so many hundreds of thousands of people in the Indian Ocean a couple of years ago. A theistic science might very well say the cause for that wasn't plate tectonics, it wasn't a deep sea earthquake. The cause for that was God deciding to punish the people who live along the Indian Ocean for their sins. Now, God's ways are mysterious, and they're certainly mysterious to me. But scientifically, we don't plug God in as a causal explanation for anything for the very simple reason that even if it's true, it's not testable. And if it's not testable, it's part of science. So I describe myself, and a lot of people like me, as being theists and evolutionists, but not as being theistic evolutionists. I wouldn't call somebody a theistic chemist or a theistic physicist for the very same reason. Then you also asked me if I could distinguish between science and the philosophy of science. And the answer is, yeah, I think science has a very simple definition, which is it is the human activity of seeking natural explanations for natural phenomena. That's what scientists do. Science, in a way, is kind of organized common sense. The philosophy of science is a way of thinking that seeks to explain why science works so well, how science works, and ponders a really deep question. And that really deep question is what scientists do when they explain the natural world, does it really tell us anything about the way nature actually is, or does it simply tell us something about how human beings perceive nature? And in a sense, that's not a scientific question, which is why it's a branch of philosophy. So, Dan, I don't know if that answers your questions, but it's certainly how I would react to them.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Something along slightly similar lines here. This is from a pastor, Pastor David Fremming, and he says that he read your book, Finding Darwin's God, in his seminary program. You mentioned the Baltimore Catechism on page 253, which he found odd, and missing were references to such thinkers as Pierre Teilhard?
Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Okay, and Thomas Berry. Your work is important because unless evolution is dealt with in our faith, we cannot seriously address our relationship with the earth and in the environment.
I agree with him. It's funny when he mentions, he says, my work is missing the work of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin was a very important paleontologist, a scientist, and also a Jesuit priest. And he was a deeply religious man. He wrote a widely read book called The Phenomenon of Man, and argued, as Reverend Fremming, I think, is, that you can't understand the phenomenon of man without understanding the process of evolution and our evolutionary history. So I know who this gentleman was, and I certainly know a little bit about his thinking. I have to make a confession, though, and confession, of course, is always good for the soul, which is I have actually never read Teilhard de Chardin's books. And it's on my reading list, one of those things that all of us have, saying this is a book I want to read when I get the time. And I apologize to Reverend Fremming for not being as familiar as I should with the ideas of this great Jesuit thinker.
Okay. Well, you can't do everything, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
thanks for giving me a pass on that one, Kathleen. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I want to hear more about this court trial, which received so much national attention that forced the school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, to stop talking about replacing evolution with intelligent design. How did you get called for that? What was it like? I think Darwin's great-grandson was involved in that, too, wasn't he?
Yes, Matthew Chapman, who is indeed Darwin's great-grandson from Great Britain, attended every day of the trial and wrote a book about it.
Isn't that something? So how did they call you? And tell me what happened with what I understand was a fairly conservative judge who ruled in your favor.
Well, the way in which this happened, Dover, Pennsylvania is a small town. Only about 14,000 or 15,000 people, pretty small high school. And the school board, as school boards are wont to do, looked over their budget one year, and they realized that the science teachers had been pestering them to buy new up-to-date science books for years. And they said, hey, we got enough money. Why don't you guys go out? There are three biology teachers in Dover High. Why don't you guys decide which book you want and let us see what it is, and we'll give you the money. Well, they looked all around, and they decided that the book that best fit the Pennsylvania State Science Standards was the book I co-authored, Biology by Miller and Levine. It's published by a company called Prentice Hall. And they said this is the book that we want. Well, in the most recent school board elections, a group of religious fundamentalists had gained a majority on the board, roughly by 6-3. And one of those people, a guy named William Buckingham, looked at our book and said, this book is laced with Darwinism. And I want a book that teaches creation. This is what he said. I want a book that teaches creation as well as evolution. Well, to make a long story short, a majority on the board went back to the teachers and said, we won't let you have this book unless we also find a book that can teach creationism or intelligent design. Well, they found such a book. It was called Of Pandas and People. And it was a book that basically says that evolution is incorrect, and here's this wonderful theory called intelligent design. And they said, okay, we want this book too. And the biology teachers, I think very much to their credit, said, no way. This book is not a scientific book. These ideas are religiously inspired. There's no scientific evidence behind them. We don't want it in the classroom. Well, the school board then said that an anonymous donor had bought two classroom sets of this Pandas and People book, and they would now allow the teachers to get their new science books, which is our book, but they wanted them to also teach lessons out of Pandas and People. Now, once again, the teachers, these only three of them, small town, at the risk of being fired, the teachers refused. Finally, the school board sat down. They wrote up their own little four-paragraph intelligent design lesson to tell students about intelligent design, and they told the teachers, would you at least read this to the kids? And once again, they refused. So the school board had the superintendent of school, if he actually had to do this, go into the biology classrooms while the teachers literally stood outside in the hallway and read this statement. Well, after they did this, the next morning, 11 parents of kids in the school district filed a lawsuit in federal court saying that their First Amendment rights as Americans had been violated because these ideas were religious in nature, and they didn't reflect their view of religion, so the state had, in effect, established a religion in violation of the First Amendment. And as that case moved to court, I got a phone call from a couple of the parents. And the parents said, "I know you've been outspoken on evolution. You wrote the textbook that our teachers wanted. Is there any chance that you would be willing to come to the trial and testify as to what's in your textbook, what your views are on this, and what the scientific basis for evolution is?" And I said, "I'd be happy to." So that, first of all, that's how I got involved in the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was at issue was whether the school board's policy violated the First Amendment. And your listeners who are up on how the First Amendment law is interpreted will refer to something called the Lemon Test. Now, it doesn't refer to fruit, but it refers to a legal case involving a plaintiff named Lemon. And the Supreme Court has maintained for about 30 years that there are three tests you can put to see if an act of government is unconstitutional. The first one is if the intent of the government action is either to advance or to hinder religion, it's unconstitutional. Second test is, well, even if that's not their intent, if the effect is to advance or hinder religion, then it's unconstitutional. And the third prong of this test, it's the most controversial one, is if neither one nor two is true, but it promotes an excessive entanglement between church and state, it's unconstitutional. Well, because the school board had said publicly that they wanted to have this curriculum because they wanted to advance creationism, they really met the first test, which is their intent was to advance a particular kind of religious point of view. And in the trial, which lasted for 7 weeks, a lot of people who attended the meetings, the school board's own memos, and actually the testimony of large numbers of people established that this really was the intent of the school board. What I did in opening the trial, because I was the first witness for the first 2 days of the trial, was to explain the scientific evidence behind evolution and to show that intelligent design, as the school board wanted to embrace it, was not a valid scientific theory. And nothing I've ever done in my scientific career has prepared me for being in a courtroom and being subject to hostile cross-examination by a highly skilled attorney. But that's certainly what I went through. I don't want to do it again, but no. It was an unforgettable experience. And your listeners who hadn't followed the details of this trial, there was a wonderful two-hour television program on Nova called Judgment Day.
Yes.
Intelligent Design on Trial, and you can still watch that program, streaming video, at the Nova website. It's called Judgment Day, and it aired in November last year.
More phone calls in just a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Only a Theory, Evolution and the Battle for America's Soul. Kenneth Miller is our guest, and Professor Miller is professor of biology at Brown University. He is the author, co-author of 4 high school and college biology textbooks that are used by millions of students nationwide. Little did he know that they would become somewhat controversial in the 20th century. And he was also, as you heard, the lead witness for 2 days on the stand for the successful lawsuit that forced the school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, to abandon what they wanted to do, which was to replace evolution with intelligent design. And we'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls. Mary is next from Kenosha. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a book in my lap right here named Thank God for Evolution by Michael Dowd, D-O-W-D. I've been hoping you'd have him on the public radio sometime soon.
I hope you do, too, because I think Michael's book is very interesting. It would make for great discussion, and I agree with many of the points he makes in it.
Good. It just makes my heart sing to read the ideas that are presented in this book, and it sort of gets a lot of mud out of it and adds a lot of music to life.
Yes,
and I just hope a lot more people read it.
I hope so, too. And I have to say that many of the points he makes are also ones that I made in a book a few years ago called Finding Darwin's God, A Scientist's Search for Common Ground Between God and Evolution. And one of the critical insights that people sometimes miss when they get hung up on the religion versus science thing is the notion of a continuing creation, in other words, a universe that continues to make itself, is actually very much in the Christian tradition. St. Augustine, writing 1,500 years ago, wrote that God does not so much create the universe as to allow the universe to create itself. And there's a traditional Christian doctrine called Creatio Continua, in which the idea of a continuing creation is seen as part of the Creator's plan. And ironically, many people who believe that they are defending religious faith or Christianity in particular seem to argue that the only way God could create is this static, instantaneous, inflexible creation in which everything is fixed on the first day of creation and nothing changes ever since. The reality is that life is a lot more clever than that. Life has grown, evolved. We are sort of the flowers of that that creative, that evolutionary event, and I think we should be proud of that, and I think it is only fair for believers to point out that we live in a universe that is just bursting with evolutionary possibilities for life, and you know what? I think that's a glorious thing.
Thanks so much, Mary, for your call. Boyd is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Dr. Miller. I will make it a point to read your books on my summer reading list.
Oh, thanks a lot. I really appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, and it's been too long since I've read some books on science. You know, the thing that I find very alarming is I think with what you make with evolution, you know, in various school districts, either not being taught at all or being very limited, I think a lot of it has to go to just how schools are being funded. And I think it's a huge concern, and I think a lot of the funding that is put into schools is actually not going toward the students, it's going toward the administration. I look at history as another example, and it's just very disturbing how some of the high school students are asking basic questions like, well, who won the Civil War? And just two other comments I wanted to make was, a lot of what you talked about reminded me of a book I read many years ago, The Demon Haunted World by Carl Sagan.
Right.
He talked about how a lot of science programs, and not only science, but arts, philosophy, were just being cast aside, and yet people were more interested in UFOs and you know, tarot card readings, for that matter. And just my final comment, I remember about 2 months ago, Ira Flatow from Science Friday was in Milwaukee, and it was a wonderful experience and having the chance to briefly meet him. But you know what? He said something that I just found very disturbing. He said, every week I have to wonder if my show is going to still be on the air because of lack of funding.
Indeed.
I found that very disturbing.
I find it disturbing, too, because first of all, I think Science Friday is a great program. And Ira Flatow is a wonderful host, and the scientists who've been on that show, and I've been on there several times, have enormous respect for Ira Flatow because he really understands science, and that's saying something. You know, you talked about media coverage. Heck, I'd be happy if science got half the coverage that Britney Spears does,
right,
in the popular media, and we consider the relative importance of the two. I think you could even argue for equal coverage, and I think that would be fine. One of the things that I've spoken with great passion about to my fellow scientists. I'm a cell biologist, and I've spoken about this to the American Society for Cell Biology, the Biochemical Society, the Biophysical Society, is that sometimes we in the scientific community are our own worst enemies, because sometimes we kind of look down upon scientists who are involved in popularization, speaking to the media, you know, going on TV and stuff like that, and they say, well, they're just, you know, media people. The reality is that the scientists who do that, who do what Carl Sagan did and what Stephen Jay Gould did, and thinking farther back, Mr. Wizard, Wernher von Braun, these are the best friends the scientific community has. And we have to be willing to go, in a democracy like ours, we in the scientific community who love science have to be willing to go into the media, make the case for science, and let people see
yes.
the passionate enthusiasm that we have for science, and also the promise that science holds for all of us for a better future. We got to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Pete from La Crosse is next. About a minute left. Hi, Pete.
Okay, I'll have to be quick. Hi, Kathleen. Ken.
Hi.
The thing that I think should be emphasized more about theories is that they have predictive values.
Indeed.
Whether it's predicting the flight of a cannonball, or I got to be quick here, or predicting climate change. And I wonder if what's in question here in our culture is just the questioning the ability of a theory to predict anything, and therefore whatever happens to us is beyond our control. You can't predict climate change. You can't predict any changes in anything, so just let it happen.
Yes, I think you're quite right about that. And I think part of the strategy that's used against evolution, that's used against people who are concerned about climate change, and was used against people who were concerned, for example, about the health effects of cigarettes, is this culture of doubt. We can't be sure. We need more research. We shouldn't teach these things. We shouldn't act on these things unless we're certain. And the reality is, as you say, that science and scientific theories have predictive value, and that's what makes science useful.
And thank you very much for the call. Kenneth, a great hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it was my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Kenneth Miller, and the book is Only a Theory, Evolution in the Battle for America's Soul. It has just been published by Viking. He's a professor of biology at Brown University, lectures widely, has appeared on Science Friday, as you heard him say, on several occasions, and is the co-author of 4 high school and college biology textbooks that are used by millions of students all over the country. His scientific papers and reviews have appeared in leading journals, including Cell, Nature, and Scientific American. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your interesting calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Many more hours of conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.